So nice to have you back, Colin, on this podcast.
Certainly glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
My pleasure. And let's get started with the conflict in the Middle East. How do you find the current state of the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel?
You know, it's bizarre on the one hand, because you see the Israeli side with such fervency talk about how they want to, quote, destroy Hezbollah. That's the same language they used about Hamas shortly after October 7th. And you see that when they were fighting that war, now it's closing in on a year, hard to believe, in a hermetically sealed environment where there's a fence around it. It's, you know, they can't get anything in or out, and yet they still haven't been able to destroy Hamas, because as I've been arguing since the outset, they're really trying to pursue a political objective with military force that cannot be succeeded there. Because when you kill so many innocent people, when you literally wipe out all the infrastructure, all you do is create more hatred and more animosity for the Israeli regime. And therefore, no matter how many Hamas fighters you actually kill, you've created so many more, and the war continues on. That's what's happening there. Now then, you see them using that same language and some of the same tactics so far that they're trying in the north. But this situation is radically different from a military perspective than the Hamas side, because there is no hermetically sealed anything. We're not talking about, you know, a relatively small number of square kilometers. We're talking about an open-ended country with access to get anything in it once. And even more importantly, this is not like a bunch of cities where, you know, that's relatively contained where people can be and it's easy to blow up buildings. This is out in the middle of much of it, open, rocky, mountainous countryside, and places where the Hezbollah side has been spending the better part of two decades preparing for just such an incursion for the Israeli military to go into Lebanon. And that is Israel's greatest vulnerability. So far, they have all the advantages in the air, in the missile forces, in the air defense. I mean, Israel has every advantage so far, and they're exploiting it. But the minute that they go in on the ground, the advantages switch over to the Hezbollah side, because that's where they're prepared for it, and that's where they have the strength and advantages. They know the terrain. Not only do they know it, but they have set up probably all places, kinds of places where they can have ambushes. They have ammunition and other supplies stockpiled probably to last quite a long time. They will be able to bring out anti-tank mines, anti-tank missiles. They'll be able to pop up from unknown places and go back down, et cetera. All the things that they have to their advantage, and that the attacking force would have, you know, especially the further they go, then they've got long lines of communication. The logistics lines will be interdicted, et cetera. And maybe the biggest thing that the Hezbollah side has not yet done is to really unleash its missile forces. We've heard a lot about this really for a long, long time, that they have somewhere between 100 and 200,000 missiles and rockets of various sorts, many of which are apparently the modern version, stuff that they didn't have in the 2006 Second Lebanon War. And they have thus far held back on using them. And my belief is that they want to maximize the possibility of use. If Hezbollah were to launch like now, and by some estimates, you're like, wow, as hard as they've been hit here recently, as many hundreds of people have been killed, they should have every justification in the world to strike back if they had that capacity. Some have argued that since they haven't, then that means they don't actually have that capacity. But I read it differently. I think that they're actually keeping their powder dry, and that they're showing a remarkable restraint and patience, because if they hold them off and do that, and then Israel does its incursion, now then global public opinion will be even more against Israel, because they have invaded another country, outright invaded another country. And then if Hezbollah returns fire, now then they're seen as just responding to what's happening. So it will deprive Israel, I think, of an important political or diplomatic advantage, which might not be that much on the surface, but there's a military component as well. If Israel then gets involved or with this incursion, and it starts to get even a little bit bogged down, because now then they're going to be fighting. They still have to fight in the Gaza Strip. That's not going away. And now then they've opened a new northern border. And then if the rockets start coming in, and if Hezbollah is wise about how they do it, they will do it in barrages and waves. that will overcome the Iron Dome system, which so far has continued to work on this small ones, like the one, the rocket that went into Tel Aviv the other day. It was like a single shot, and it was knocked down, of course, because Israel has the air defense to do that. But when all of a sudden there are waves of those things coming in, it can overwhelm the air defense systems, and they just won't have enough interceptor missiles to take care of everything. And then they'll be incredibly vulnerable to virtually anything that Hezbollah fires. So there is a real risk for Israel to go in there. And frankly, I don't see any upside. You're not going to destroy Hezbollah militarily. You're not going to go in with the ground force, because Israel's ground force isn't big enough to go in to accomplish that objective, which they claim they're going to seek, which is to force Hezbollah back north of the Litani River. It's just too far. There's too much terrain and likely too many troops in there to be able to do that. And on top of having already fought nearly a year in the south, it's just hard for me to see how they're going to continue to do that, because this will, I assure you, make the casualties go way up percentage-wise to what they have over the last year.
Yeah. Can you understand why they're insisting on sending troops on the ground in Lebanon? Because as you mentioned, there is no outcome for Israel. But are they still hoping that the United States would help them or would get involved in the conflict? That's why they're insisting on this concept.
We'll see if it gets that far, because they so far haven't. They have been massing forces down there. Everything that we've seen so far, going all the way back to the pager and the walkie-talkie issue, the assassinations of the senior leadership in Beirut, and then now then all of these airstrikes throughout the depth of the potential battle force are classic moves to try and decapitate the leadership and to cut off the communications or hamper it, and then physically hit arms depots and weapons and ammunition, all that sort of thing, specific targets to soften up the enemy before a ground incursion. It's classic preparation of the battlefield. But they haven't done it yet, so it remains to be seen whether they will. But to me, when you look at this from the strategic position, not just this the Hezbollah side, but the whole thing, the whole region involved, it really looks to me like over the last, especially 4 or 5 months, that Israel's doing everything it can to spark a wider war so that the United States will come in. And that hope is not without some justification, because you've had too many times where the Secretary of Defense of the U.S., the Secretary of State, National Security Advisor have expressly said that if Iran specifically ever does anything to Israel, of course, we will go and protect them like we did last time, a reference to the April situation to where Israel destroyed an embassy compound of the Iranians in Syria. And in retaliation, Iran launched this 350 rocket drone strike, et cetera. And we used our air force to physically shoot down like 70 of those projectiles. So we have said subsequently that if Iran joins in again, we'll help them again. And I think that Israel is doing everything it can to spawn such an event so that we, quote, have to come in on their side, because they don't have the capacity. They don't have the capacity, in my estimation, to drive anybody 25 kilometers through the entire breadth of that country up to the Litani River. That would just be, I mean, Israel's only 8 million total people, and their armed forces just aren't that big. I don't think you can sustain that kind of combat. And if Israel or Iran gets involved, even less so. So I think that they're trying to get the U.S. sucked in. And it looks to me like they're willing to roll the dice and start an operation that they can't finish on their own, with the expectation that we'll come and bail them out. And listen, I've been going on. I was on Fox News yesterday, News Nation the day before, everywhere I can to say we, United States, must not get involved with this war. And we should unequivocally tell Israel, especially behind the scenes, do not take this action here. Do not start a war with Iran. Do not start a war in Lebanon, because if you do, you're on your own. We're not going to help you with anything. You make your sovereign choice. You can do whatever you want, but we are not going to get sucked into a war. We will not fight a war for you. That is what we should do. And if we did that, then Israel would have the hard position to go, okay, crap. If they're not going to fight with me, and I mean not just supply ammunition, but fight with us, then we can't do this, because then we would lose. And now then you could have a literal popular uprising at home in Israel if they start this and the casualties go up and they can't succeed and they can't accomplish even partially their objectives. So they would have to say, all right, we need to take a suppressant here and not go in. We'll just say, all right, we just did some air campaign to weaken the enemy, and we'll do it again if they act badly or whatever they want to say. But then they might not invade. But if they don't have that assurance and we keep talking as feckless and weak as we have, then I think that the chances are high that they're going to continue on and trying to get Iran involved.
Yeah. We have the new president of Iran together with his team in New York. And his vice president was giving an interview to MSNBC in which he was talking about this bombing of walkie-talkies and pagers. And here is what he said in that respect.
In Lebanon, the explosions of the pagers and the walkie-talkies. Is Iran concerned about the security of your own electronic devices?
Well, actually, Israel has made the international electronic business unsafe for everybody, not just for Iran. This was a huge blow to business security in the world.
Is it a blow to the security of Iran's military to communicate?
No, our military has the capability to detect this.
Let me ask you about...
Yeah. Colonel, the question is right now, in terms of military strategy, do you find any sort of strategy behind this type of bombing that we haven't seen before?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And as long as it was tied to a larger operation, then it makes a lot of military sense. We'll take the morals out of it for the moment, because a lot of it was used on civilians, and doctors and children were killed in the process of this. So that's a separate issue that does need to be addressed. But on a military perspective, if you're planning on going in and invading a country, it makes all the sense in the world, because you would want to disrupt their communications, destroy their confidence in what other devices they have, make it very difficult for them to coordinate actions, to communicate. So as you're moving up on the battlefield, it's hard for the enemy to figure out where you're at, to communicate back to their colleagues, et cetera. And you may recall a couple of months before all this, the smartphones, et cetera, had already been banned because they had been compromised. So that really leaves some, you know, very limited communication means, and to try new things, whether it's fiber optic cables or something like that can't be interdicted, but that has limitations as well, or messengers on scooters or whatever else, but that's time delayed, et cetera. So it really slows down that. And then if you take out the leadership on top of that, now then you have new people coming in, and there's just lots of chaos. So when an invasion happens in the midst of a lot of leadership chaos and the inability to communicate effectively and trying to figure all this out on the fly, then it makes your defenses a lot weaker. So I'm sure that that's what was going on, or I believe it was, if the ground incursion comes.
And how about Israel right now? We have Gallant, the defense minister of Israel, was not willing to go into Lebanon, to go on the ground in Lebanon. Right now, it seems that they could change his decision. How do you find it right now in Israel? Is there any political figure that who's against this type of policy of making new conflict with Lebanon, and while they're having the conflict in Gaza?
I'm sure there is, because there's a lot of I want to say Benny Gantz has shown some reservations, but in the ruling party, I don't see any. In fact, I saw just before we came on here that there's the U.S. and France is proposing a 21-day ceasefire in Israel, and I saw that Ben Gavir said he would resign from the cabinet if that came to be. You know, he is passionately against anything like that. I heard also a headline, I don't know how true it was, that Netanyahu himself categorically rejected it, has no interest in it. But that, of course, feeds into my theory that they don't want a ceasefire, whether in the Hamas fight or in the Lebanese fight, because they want a war. They want to draw the United States in, and to have a ceasefire would interrupt both of those objectives.
The other thing would be the policy of Donald Trump. Recently, he was talking about China, and right now about Iran today, yesterday. And he said, let me play it for you,
sure,
what he said.
Two assassination attempts on my life that we know of, and they may or may not involve but possibly do, Iran. But I don't really know, can't be sure, because in the first case in Butler, Pennsylvania, great place, and we're going back to Butler, by the way, we're going to go back and finish our speech. The FBI has been unable to open the three potentially foreign-based apps. And in the second case, the assassin had six cell phones in his car, yet the FBI has likewise been unable to penetrate their guard.
Colonel, again, we have, I personally have a lot of hope in the Trump administration if he can do something about the conflict in Ukraine. But you see the shift is coming on China and Iran right now. And do you think these people are getting stronger in the future Trump administration? The people around him, they're just injecting this type of, because it doesn't seem that it would come from him. It seems that somebody's providing him with information that maybe Iran, that we haven't seen so far anything coming out that Iran would assassinate Donald Trump right now that he's a Republican candidate for the presidential election. Why would they do that, in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I can never get into the minds of what may or may not be going on with any Tehran leaders. Obviously, we've assassinated some of their top people, with Soleimani being one of the key ones. Israel has assassinated some of their people, obviously the ones in their embassy, et cetera. And they often view us as a single entity. But, you know, Trump has a lot of bad blood, you know, going back. I mean, he was probably told by a lot of these senior people that he put on his administration in, you know, the 2016 election when he won. And that's why he was so emphatic about getting rid of the nuclear deal that Obama had done prior to that. Because I don't know why, because prior to that election campaign, I didn't see anything that showed any pre-existing animosity towards or hatred of Iran, but somebody gave him that, because then he took it into office and acted on it and all the sanctions and everything else. So now if someone's now telling him, oh, by the way, they tried to kill you. And if he believes it, then you can see why he would say some of those things. But I'm with you that I'm, you know, fully supportive of what he said on the 25th of September, just a couple of days back, on the Russia-Ukraine war. And that makes enormous sense. But then going the opposite direction here, and he's always had an agitated spot for China, too. So, man, I don't know who's on his team advising of those things. But if I was on there, I would sure be pushing back.
Yeah. Here is what the vice president of Iran said in terms of interfering in the U.S. election in favor of any of these candidates.
Officials from the previous administration and this administration, military as well as diplomatic, who were under 24-hour guard because of, they say, threats of assassination from Iran through third parties.
Well, we do not assassinate people, but the fact of the matter is they assassinated a revered Iranian general.
General Soleimani.
General Soleimani. In a foreign territory, violating Iraqi sovereignty and violating international law. And they boasted about it. We don't boast about anything.
But is that a reason to have threats to kill the generals involved?
Well, actions have consequences. We have not taken action against them. We have said that we will pursue legal action against them.
What do you see as the future of your country? You're a new reformist administration.
Yeah. He said that we are not going to assassinate. At least he's the vice president of Iran right now. He's talking right now in New York. He says that we are not pursuing. In terms of assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, I don't know if you saw the video that the president of Iran gave, the interview that he gave to CNN. He said, we are asking the international community to do something to make Netanyahu understand what he's doing with this assassination that has been going on, for decades.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I understand that the desire to for people to do that, you know, to hold people accountable. I mean, we always claim here in the United States that, you know, we stand up for a rules-based international order and the following the rule of law and all that. But I mean, you can't get past the fact that when it comes to actions that our side does that violate those laws graphically, that nothing happens. And so it just shamefully exposes that we have a double standard that basically is we do whatever we want on our side and we'll hold everyone else accountable to our standards on the other side. And of course that never works. It just makes people more angry. It increases hatred, and ultimately will probably help spawn actions against us that we don't like. He claims, you know, the vice president there that they don't do any assassinations. Frankly, in this day and age, there's not many governments around the world that would hesitate to take out an opponent and assassinate somebody if they thought it was in their interest and they could get away with it. So I honestly don't put much stock in any public statements because we've said a lot of things publicly that are obviously not true. So all we look at is actions. And I think that if Iran could do something, they could take out somebody and they thought that they could do it and not, you know, suffer a cruise missile strike in the front door of their presidential palace or something like that, I have no doubts that they would do that. But they are constrained because they do have limitations and there would be consequences if they're, you know, it's discovered that they did something like that. So that's just the position that they find themselves in.
Yeah, Colonel, the other thing, I remember in 2016 when Donald Trump was running against Hillary, and he, if you remember, he was talking about how he's going to withdraw the troops from Syria. And in those days, the leader of Iran, it was so amazing. He was just supporting Donald Trump and saying, this guy going to change something in the Middle East. This guy going to withdraw the troops. And in those days, he was in favor of Donald Trump over Hillary. And right now, do you see any sort of possibility when it comes to the Middle East that Donald Trump would be capable of changing anything in the Middle East?
Look, you got to look back at what he did in office. And there were three separate times when he declared that he was going to withdraw the troops from Syria. Once he got into office, at first he said, all right, well, I'm going to leave them there and finish the job to take the territory away from ISIS in Mosul and in Raqqa in Syria. And then once that was done by, I think it was March of 2019, it may have been, I can't remember the exact time, but he declared mission accomplished, we're bringing the troops home. But then he allowed the internal pressure of the, some call it the deep state. You can call it whatever you want, but the internal pressure within the country, the United States, both in his administration and just in the, you know, the so-called elite of foreign policy in Washington, they pushed back so hard against that, some in the Pentagon as well, and that he gave in and that he didn't do it. So three times he said he would, three times he didn't. When he had the power, he's the commander in chief. He has the authority given to him by the Constitution to just give an order, move the troops out, period. I don't want any talk. I don't want any discussion. I gave you an order, execute it. That's what he should have said to his generals. But instead, he allowed himself to be talked out of it. He also allowed himself to be talked out of having all the troops withdrawn from Afghanistan before he left office. Not a lot of people know about that, but there was a signed order from Trump to have all the troops removed by the 17th of January of 2021. And in testimony, we have subsequently seen the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, went along with the acting secretary of defense at the time and talked him out of it. And he allowed himself to be talked out of it. Now, if he can allow himself to be talked out of something like that, that actually makes a lot of sense and could have been done in good military order, just imagine all the chaos that resulted from the way the Biden administration got out of Afghanistan could have been avoided if they had just followed the order that was originally given and gotten out when they were told to, because the Taliban was not yet strong enough to overcome it. But he failed to do that, and then we had what we had. So now then you want to talk about looking forward, and especially in light of that quote you just put there and his now, you know, even more apparent hatred of Iran. I mean, I just don't see how he's going to do that. I wonder if he would be strong enough to do what he said he would do in the Russia-Ukraine war, to end that, to bring that to a negotiated settlement, because there's definitely a lot of industrial pressure within the U.S. foreign policy and military communities in the United States that already are pushing back against that significantly. I mean, you saw that there was just this letter by 100 so-called defense experts for Kamala Harris, because she will stay the course on all of these conflicts that are going on right now. So you see the institutional pressure is immense to just keep going on with the war. So it would take a strong leader to stand up and say, y'all all shut up. I'm now the president elected by the people with the power of the Constitution. We will end this, move on, and then take all the heat that would come from it. That takes a tough leader and somebody who is very confident in his abilities and who also knows how things work. And I don't know that we have anyone that meets those criteria, so I don't have a lot of hope that that will change after this election.
Yeah, here comes the point that Vladimir Putin was raising about predictability of the U.S. president. And before this, Donald Trump was talking about in a talk Russia and Ukraine. He has mentioned that we are losing Iran. The economy is just getting away from us. We have to do something with Iran. And right now he's talking this way. Here comes the question to the mind of Putin, Xi, and the leader of Iran. Who's Donald Trump? Is this A, B, C? And who's influencing him? Who's behind the scene driving the show? And it's when Vladimir Putin talked about that we would be in favor of Kamala Harris, he was talking about the U.S. presidential election. And because of the predictability that we're witnessing on the part of the Democratic Party, I think there is he's sincere about some of the meaning of this type of talk when he's talking about predictability. He really mean it. And we don't see, do you think that Donald Trump would be the same as he was in his first term?
I honestly think that Putin, Xi, the Ayatollah, Kim Jong-un, and even the rest of, our allies around in various parts of the world, I think that they are coming to the position where they're like, it doesn't matter who's president, because the American foreign policy, and this is really going back for quite a long, there's hardly any difference between Republican and Democrat in the foreign policy areas. I mean, you're talking about some significant differences between the leadership styles and some of the domestic policies of Obama to Trump, going back to Clinton before that, George Bush, now Biden. It's a lot of differences there. But when it comes to foreign policy, you can hardly tell any difference. And I think that most of the leaders elsewhere around the world are coming to recognize that it's not going to matter who wins. They're going to do whatever they've been doing, and then they're going to make policies accordingly. And so I don't think that they spend a lot of time wondering which Trump they're going to get. I think that they just figure it's going to continue on with the status quo, regardless of who wins.
Yeah. And in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, recently we had a meeting between Biden and Starmer in which it seems that Pentagon was playing a very significant role in the policy, in terms of the foreign policy of the United States in Ukraine, in order to not to send those long-range missiles to Ukraine. How do you see the current policy? Are they going to send long-range missiles to Ukraine, or we can be sure that they're not going to do that?
We definitely can't be sure they're not going to do that. I have some sources that claim knowledge that behind the scenes that Russia was unequivocal privately to U.S. Interlocutors, especially that if you use those long range, what Putin said, he means it, that we will consider you a direct participant in the war and we will take actions accordingly. They were not specific about what they want to do. Putin has been talking a lot about his nuclear doctrine. He's been talking about that for a long time. Lavrov have talked about a change. And then you had yesterday, Putin gave even more detailed changes to his nuclear doctrine, which basically widened their potential use and lowered the threshold for it. I don't think that if you see a long-range missile used by the U.S., French, or British, and it lands on a strategic target deep inside of Russia, I don't think that the next day, an hour later, you're going to see a nuclear missile going anywhere. I doubt that they would ramp it up that high that fast. But you could see some conventional missiles firing into NATO territory, which would spark an existential crisis and put us, on an October 1962 threshold of possible nuclear escalation. And man, God help us if we get to that point, because the leadership that we have today is, I don't think, as good as Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy at the time. Those were both statesmen, and they were wise and made the right choice, as it turns out. They both made the compromises necessary to tamp things down. I don't see that kind of leadership anywhere in the West today, in any country, frankly. We've produced a lot of pretty weak leaders, and so it would be frightening if you had a weak leader on the U.S. side of that equation to try and find some way to not escalate into a nuclear exchange. That given, though, it would seem reasonable, and actually it would seem obvious, that we would not give the long-range weapons, because you dare not find out if Putin is bluffing, that he wouldn't do that. But you have a ton of people from that same military-industrial complex, if you will, that same foreign policy elite going, like, putting on the double teams, trying to press for Biden to give this authorization. You had five former secretaries of defense, Ministry of Defense in Britain, and a former prime minister advocating release this. You had a letter of a whole bunch of former U.S. generals and diplomats telling Biden, give the permission here. I see it on American television every day. They say, Putin is bluffing. He didn't do this, that, and the other thing that they claim. The red lines were passed and he didn't do anything. Ergo, he never will. So do whatever you want to do. Use these long range, etc. So I would think that the obvious answer would be no, they won't. And that I'm still leaning that direction. But unfortunately, we have information that prior to the start of the war itself in June of 2021, that Putin behind the scenes privately and directly told Biden, if you keep going in with NATO into Ukraine, we will go to war for it. He apparently point blank told him. I'm told this by a diplomat who claims to have knowledge about that interaction. And Biden reportedly said, okay, do whatever you think you can do, because if you do, we'll crush you and you'll lose, because we're a lot stronger than you are. We'll devastate your economy and you'll end up losing anyway, but you know, whatever. Instead of doing anything to try and talk him down out of it. Well, you know that especially in December of 21, Putin said, you either back off of this deal to get it NATO in, or we will take military technical measures in response. And he said that in light of having a couple hundred thousand troops surrounding the border. Now, he wasn't bluffing then. He made good on it. So when he makes a similar kind of threat now, specifically about long-range weapons being used in his country, and then yesterday he expressly said, if you have the confluence of a nuclear and non-nuclear state working together, and they even fire conventional missiles into our country, or large numbers of drones or aircraft or missiles, et cetera, then we will consider it fair game to use nuclear weapons. So we damn sure better not test that threshold to find out if this one is a bluff when the other one, the big one, the war-making one, wasn't a bluff in the past. So I hope we don't, but honestly, we ignored it that last time, and I don't know if we're smart enough to ignore it this time.
Yeah. When it comes to the conflict in the Middle East, we know that Netanyahu is so much powerful and has a lot of leverage in the United States to manipulate everything. But for the case of Ukraine, how do you see it? Is Zelensky is getting more leverage in the United States to put some sort of pressure on the Biden administration, or is the Biden administration who is driving the show? Who is
no? It's in my view, Zelensky is a tool. He is being used because there are powerful Western assets that absolutely want the war to continue on. They don't want it to expand. They don't want it to go nuclear, but they do want it to continue on, because anything that continues to, quote, hurt Russia is something that they want. And you don't have to go any further than that to see Lindsey Graham, who routinely brags about, yes, we should continue to give them everything that they want and all the weapons that they want to continue fighting. And he goes to Kiev and he, pats Zelensky on the back and says, yeah, keep fighting, recruit more people. That's what you need to do. You need to expand the people that you mobilize, lower the age, do whatever you got to do. So they're pushing him to that. We have information from the retired German chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, who a week or so ago specified what happened in April of 2022 when we thought we had a deal to end the war there in Istanbul. And he reiterated, now there's more than one course that said that it was sabotage, and Zelensky told Zelensky, don't take the deal, etc. So it's not Zelensky who's driving this train. It's the West who's pushing him in this direction. And I think he's now in this no-win situation that he can't quit. And all he can do is keep going on and keep asking for these things, even though I can't imagine that he does not cognitively understand that the war is already lost and there is zero chance it can ever be reversed on the battlefield. The only thing I can think him thinking of is in a certain sense, similar to what Netanyahu, who wants to drag the U.S. into the war to fight on his behalf. I think that he has this desperate belief that if somehow through all of these means and public appearances, he can somehow cause something like with the long range weapons. I think he does believe Putin, and that's why he wants those weapons to be used. And he wants Putin to respond so that he can now bring all of NATO in his side. I think that is his Hail Mary top choice. And I think the one thing that he is driving, because without that, he knows that his regime is going to be destroyed here shortly.
Do you find the European Union willing to get more involved directly with Russia in this conflict?
I see actually movements in the opposite direction. Now, depends on where you are too, because you have Poland and you have the Baltics, and even Sweden is starting to be a lot more, you know, afraid of what they think may be coming from Russia, and they're a lot more aggressive on that. But you start moving more to the West. Obviously, you have Slovakia, you have Hungary, Turkey, and now even Schulz in Germany saying, you know what, it's time to have a negotiated settlement. So you definitely have some big cracks in some of the major NATO players. And I think a lot of the others just want this thing to be over, and they just don't want to have to deal with it anymore. They want to get back to doing business, and they want cheap gas from Russia so they can help their own economies. I don't see anybody with other than the Baltics and Poland especially that have any interest in having any kind of a clash against Russia. And so that's just part of the reality of it. And I don't know that even Poland and the Baltics want a war. They don't want to fight Russia. They don't want to have, you know, missiles pointing on their cities and destroying their troops. But they are genuinely afraid of Russia.
Since the conflict in Ukraine started, they had high-ranked military advisors, generals talking about how Ukraine is capable of destroying Russian army. And you recently talked with General Ben Hodges. And how did you find him during the interview? Do you think that he's changing his mind? Because it's not just him. We had Petraeus, we had other military commanders who were just preaching, just talking about that Ukraine gonna win, Ukraine gonna destroy Russia. And how do you see this rhetoric right now on their part?
Yeah, I think that General Hodges especially, I think he actually believes a lot of the stuff he's saying. I can't understand why, given his military background and his experience. I don't know upon what he would base any genuine hope that things could change, but he does seem sincere about it. But there's a lot of others that I don't think are sincere about it. I think that they just want the war to go on because they want to harm Russia, and they want to keep it just short of having any impact on us. And so I don't. The words that they say, I think, are deceptive, and they're intentionally deceptive that they say that Ukraine can win when they know, I think, that they can't, but they do want the war to go on because it serves a purpose that suits them.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Colonel, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.